Welcome, everyone. Many people know tonight's speaker, but for those who don't, just a few words of introduction. He'll practice in Suzuki Roshi and Kobukino Roshi, two founders way back in the early 70s, and has been practicing Zen for a long time since then. And also practice quite extensively in Tibetan tradition. I know with Lama Tarchin Rinpoche, who lives down the road, who was kind of attending him, driving him to teachings for many years. And also has, I know, gone to England to Amaravati, the Theravada high tradition monastery, many summers for retreats with Ajahn Sumedho. So, wide range of Buddhist practice. So thank you very much for speaking today.
Thank you. I'm interested in, interested in Dogen's use of double negative. There's an example at the end of the fascicle Uji, where he says, not arriving is not yet. And there's another example, the third sentence in the Genjo Koan. The Buddha way is a leaping beyond the many and the one. Not many and not one. But what interests me is why he resorts to this ploy. Not so much what it means and how he uses it. So I'd like to approach Dogen through the side door obliquely. Go at it another way. And feel free to interrupt, because I'm not sure I know where all of you are at. In Khanza's commentary on the Heart Sutra, he lists three impediments to practice. I think they're traditional impediments. The first is karma, the consequence of willful deeds. We know it's coming, but we don't know how it will unfold or when. And the second is klesa. I think it's usually translated as a defilement, greed, hatred, and delusion. The third is the one which interests me. It's thought coverings, or citta avarana in Sanskrit. The root is vri, to cover. I don't think thought covering refers simply to neurotic or corrosive thinking, which goes in a circle and takes you nowhere. But thought itself is a cover. Does anyone have a thought as to why thought itself should be a hindrance?
Why it should be an impediment?
Impediment.
As soon as you're thinking, you're in a tunnel that's a little bit separate.
Separate, you know.
It's a separating thing.
Well, most of our thinking is done with language. Although I read about an autistic boy who solves mathematical problems by computing with colors and then comes back to numbers. Filmmakers and painters, of course, think visually. But most of our thinking is done with words, and language and logic both depend on difference, separation. And most of our thinking is what's called first order or Aristotelian logic. To two premises in that. One is the rule of identity, A equals A, and the second rule is non-contradiction, or A cannot equal not A. Buddhism has, I think, confronts both of those. The first, A equals A, the law of identity, is confronted by the Buddhist notion of no self. And the second, non-contradiction, is met with a Buddhist assertion of true contradiction. For instance, samsara, the world of suffering, is equal to nirvana, the Western paradise, or whatever you care to call it. Or kalesa, defilements, are the same as bodhi, awakening. Aristotle, somewhere in the Metaphysics, says if we admit contradiction, then everything is one. That's not a conclusion he wants to reach. Let's see. There are also simple words like pharmakon, which means both poison and cure at the same time, or tathagata, depending on where you put the second A sound, it means thus come or thus gone. No questions so far. So I think the problem we want to address is how to remove these this thought covering, how to... how to take the cover off and let radiance shine. The assertion of true contradiction is fairly old. Apparently it usually credited to Heraclitus, the Greek pre-Socratic thinker. It's picked up in the 15th century by a German cardinal, Nicholas de Cusa, who says that God is the coincidence of contraries. Everything is reconciled in him. And the next century, Giordano Bruno asserts the identity of opposites. These ideas are picked up in the 20th century by people like F. Scott Fitzgerald, who says the creative mind can hold contradictory ideas simultaneously. Or, I don't know if you know Freud's amusing dictum that contradiction is not permitted in logic. Everywhere else it is a rule. And James Joyce has two characters in Finnegan's Wake, both brothers, Shem and Sean, who change hats or identities throughout. I think of another. Or Bertolt Brecht, German dramatist, says that when you're structuring a play, you want to be sure to include chaos, inconsistencies, not to edit out error.
So I was taking a walk today in the woods, and my thinking mind's going on usually about mundane stuff, this and that, is the laundry done, and this and that. And then I started, as I sometimes do as an exercise, just kind of, smell the smell of the woods and listen to the sound of the woods, and then the beauty of the sight of the woods, all the color. And so that feels real nice. And so if we're talking about, you know, thought covering, as you would call it, I'm not sure what my question is, but I would ask you about, like, doing your zazen, or how is it for you that when the thought covering is removed? If that's a fair question. I know this is probably what you're talking about.
No. Well, the problem is not thinking, it's identifying with the thinker and the storyteller. You can go on for hours listening to your own stories. But there's no necessity to identify with that that character.
What does that mean, to identify?
Well, that's me, the thinker and the storyteller. Or identify with your own karma, which is usually the subject of the story.
So is that the covering then? The identification, you're saying?
I don't think you're going to stop thinking.
Okay. So is that what you're then, your premises is? This idea of covering is this identification with me versus obviously just the ongoing process of thinking.
Well, identifying with these two tyrants, the storyteller and the thinker. First order or Aristotelian logic is tyrannical. It wants to, it calls itself reason and logic, where it's only a subset of modern logic. I don't know if I'll give you an example. In modern logic, is not obsessed with truth and falsity. It wants to treat all data as informative, true, false, unknown, whatever. So some examples would be belief logic. You don't examine the truth or falsity of someone's premises. You just see if he or she is consistent with those premises, if they're thinking. Or deontic is close to that. That's duty or ethical logic. It's concerned with the consistency of one's ethical system, not whether the premises are true or false. And one of which interests me is discursive logic, which states that no one voice has a monopoly on truth, that truth is only approached by an amalgam of many voices, like this assembly or the town hall meeting. Let's see. Then there are many valued logic, not truth-false, but truth-false and unknown. In fact, there's 3 million people in the Andes speak a language, Aymara, which has this many-valued system, true, false, and unknown. And they reverse the direction of future and past. Past is in front of us where we can see it, and future is behind us where we can't see it. So there are 3 million people running around thinking not in non-Aristotelian terms, in which the unknown is always included as one of the terms.
So you're saying that's that kind of logic is the tyranny, and then you said there was another.
No, just one of these. Modern logic thinks of Aristotelian first-order logic as a subset, one possible way of thinking. But I think in our experience, most of our thinking is true-false, or what is it, on-off, yes, no, binary. Most of our thinking is binary.
Accept and reject.
Accept and reject. This, the thrust of modern logic to include everything, all data is useful. If someone is telling you lies, that can be treated as information, as valuable as truth. Anyone know any more modern logic?
No. I noticed growing up that maybe middle school language and thought started to kick in for me. By the end of seventh grade, I was a student, which I hadn't been. And you know, on Arbor Day, the principal was digging up some soil to plant a tree. And all of a sudden, I flashed back to the year before my thoughts had kicked in. And everything was much more intense and colorful. I just remembered all of a sudden in a flash that my world had been much more intense, colorful, especially visual, but all senses. And I attribute that just to the fact that the act of thinking itself just puts you in your head, period, and takes you out of the world.
Well, I can mention one more obvious logic. It's called other worlds, which in the simplest form means that what is true today might not be true tomorrow, or what is true in Santa Cruz might not be true in Monterey. Place and time, or... The big category is modal logic. It deals with possibility, probability, and then necessity. Anyway, the modern logic is infinitely more sophisticated than this one subset, which is Aristotelian and which frequently tyrannizes us. I notice that we... that it has appropriated two words, reasonable, or reason and logic. Aristotelian logic calls itself the exclusive logic and thinks of itself as reasonable. You know. Well, let's go ahead.
I'm thinking about how young people accept or reject older people in a crowd. Very quickly, I mean much more quickly than other older people, they'll recognize what you're talking about when you say that they're following a continuity. The speaker would be speaking in such a way as to make it obvious to a young person that they know where they're coming from and they're there and they're with it. And depending on how closely aligned they are with that sense of integrity in their conversation, they are either cool or uncool. Young people will recognize that very quickly. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, they haven't been educated like us. The idea is to stop fixating on our maps and actually address the terrain. So we should consider how to remove this thought cover. I guess we can go to Dogen, unless someone has an idea. I mean, the most basic way is any unifying practice like Zazen or chanting, or any of the arts, any making. Consider the words connected with the arts, or art, artists, to join, or articulate, fashion, poetry, poesis means to make, they're all, or unify, make one. Any unifying practice is going to remove the thought cover. So Dogen is using a strategy from Indian Buddhist logic called apoha, which means the exclusion of the negation of others, which is just a simple way of most basically thinking about definition. You want to know what a cow is, so you get all the herbivorous quadrupeds into a box, and then you figure that a unicorn is not a cow, and a buffalo is not a cow, and giraffe, hippopotamus are not cows. You get all the not cows, and then you exclude cow from this category, and supposedly you know what a cow is. This device of the double negation goes back to at least two celebrated Buddhist thinkers, Indian, Dignaga in the 5th century and Dharmakirti in the 7th. So it's not unique to Dogen. But, let's see. I guess many of you know the Genjo Koan. We could begin there with the third sentence or the whole first three. I'm not sure I remember it all. The first begins with a... Do you have it? Well, let's see if I remember. First begins with an affirmation. All things are Buddha Dharma. Since all things are Buddha Dharma, there is Buddhas and sentient beings. Practice, realization and delusion, birth and death. And the next sentence says that since there is no self, there is none of the above. And then the third says the Buddha way is, does it say basically, a leaping beyond the many and the one. So, anyone have a thought on what this strategy accomplishes, I think?
And then it says, thus there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas.
But it's not the same. That third assertion is not the same as the first. What it looks like is after affirmation and denial, that leaping beyond leaves you content without a sign. It takes away affirmation and denial, or any predication about the subject. All you're left with is the naked isness or thusness of all those names, all those things, which accomplishes what I was referred to before. It returns us to immediacy without our maps. We're left with just the naked, whatever you want to call it, just this or thingness, without any appendages, without any pluses or minuses, yays or nays. No. Oh.
Is this to do with suffering?
Well, without... without the separation from immediacy, without a preoccupation with maps, I don't know if suffering is that... is a problem.
You're saying you don't feel like it's a problem?
No. Separation is the basis of the suffering I know.
So we have maps. We're guided by our maps. Is that what you're saying?
The maps have been substituted for the terrain itself. We don't take that journey. We stay at home by the coffee table and go through the maps and sip coffee.
And logic and rational thinking.
Well...
reliance on thinking?
Identification with first order thinking, not...
Because we believe our thoughts.
Yeah, I think we think we're the thinker.
So believing our thoughts is the problem.
Well, you could just let thoughts alone, either not affirm them or not deny them.
Emotionally, we believe, I think for the most part, we believe what we think.
Well, it's a belief that they describe the terrain, right?
So the belief describes the terrain?
Yeah, we have a problem with a friend, and we think of an explanation. The actual relationship, the naked relationship, is shuttled off to one side, and we have the thought or the thesis about the relationship. And of course, the more you think about it, the more you run in circles and suffer.
And you're unwilling to engage with your friend.
You've forgotten him or her long ago.
You're circling around your mind.
I came across, thinking about this, some interesting words to describe this dilemma. The first is a word, German word, used by Heidegger and picked up by the French thinkers. It's Holzweg, is that right?
Holz what?
It's a forest path that...
Holzweg.
Loud.
Holzweg.
It's a forest path that crisscrosses and turns back on itself and winds up going nowhere. And... it's very similar to Dante's Dark Wood, the beginning of his poem. I don't know Italian. Does anyone know Italian?
It's
Silva
Scura. Silva. Silva
Scura. Silva Scura.
That's the dark wood in which he finds himself at the beginning of the evening.
Well, these corridors of thought we get caught in are very much like a dark wood. The French is champ-clos, is that right? So people have been thinking about this for a long time.
Or not.
Or not. Yeah.
I wonder, when Catherine brought up that, even if it seems like we don't have to believe in our thoughts or believe that we're the thinker, but emotionally we do, right? Emotionally, the strength of that pulls us back out of maybe we could call true logic or something. So I wonder, do you think that by understanding this, this kind of, these other types of logic, is it enough to cut through the emotional adherence to the thinker? Or do we need more than
logic? The thrust of modern logic is to treat everything as information. So thoughts can no longer tyrannize you by claiming to have a monopoly on truth.
But don't, when there's emotion behind it, it seems like it overrides logic. How do you want to work with that?
Well, it's like mental illness. It's that the emotions are overriding. You know that your thoughts are crazy, but you're still convinced by them anyway.
That sounds like every day of life.
Well, it's a little more extreme.
Except you don't think your thoughts are crazy.
Well, what about just treating them as information? Not true or false, not to be relied on or acted on, but information. We're attached to our thoughts.
Yeah.
No.
Maybe we're entertained by them. I find my thoughts rather entertaining at times.
Well, you still don't have to identify with the thinker. You can.
You don't have to.
Here's another story, and you just. Here's another story, Catherine. Just sit back and.
That is a cortex run on separate tracks and don't connect. I don't understand how we're going to get these two systems together because they don't connect as far as I understand. So, feelings kick in and our thoughts are doing something else, but our feelings, stay locked on a true or false. I feel it, I believe it. Maybe it's not true, but I'm attached to it. I'm holding it some way. And thoughts seem not to have that kind of weight for us. Maybe not you.
Well, it struck home when I don't know how many years ago I read about modern logic or other worlds, that you didn't have to decide about truth or falsity. You could just attend everything as information.
Yeah, you can. I agree with you that you can try another system of understanding your thoughts. But I think in practice we address the fact that we get stuck on believing what we think when it affects us. If it's an abstract thought that has no identity with us, somebody said identity earlier, if
Don't we learn over the years that the emotions are not reliable? The actions we take on the basis of some emotive state is...
And they don't stop us from acting. Little by little, over the years.
Oh, another voice.
This is truth of the pointing of emotions that they're like overtaking our mind and distorting our perception. But I think what I heard Bill going towards and both trying to get to, and I think you haven't quite gotten through yet, was how if you are having a question about what you're experiencing, then if you apply logic alone, it just leads you to a certain edge. And once you made it to a certain edge, it actually is possible to, with your thinking, come to an insight into something that cannot be. So you were saying, a cow is not a cow. A cow is a cow because you know it's not an elephant, it's not a giraffe, it's not whatever. So, just the plain perception. So one has to already come, you're right, one has to already come to a place in one's experience where one has a question about the cow. If you like never ask question a cow ever, you probably don't need the logical work that Bill is talking about right now. But if you ever come to a place where you're like, well, maybe there's something more than all the things that I'm, all the like things that are happening in my mind, then you can. Then there are methods there of people who, logicians, who have been playing with our thoughts a little bit more than, like, it's kind of like this game where you connect, have to connect four dots, and you have to go outside the box in order to connect the dots. So it's possible to go outside and come back. I don't know if that makes sense, but why don't you say more about what Dogen has to say, and then...
Yeah, I'd get back to Dogen. Well, Wittgenstein first. He asked the question, can the fly think its way out of the fly bottle? It's probably necessary that we exhaust thought, that the fly exhaust itself and then settle down and stop buzzing. Well, I think I identified at least two or three uses Dogen makes of this apoha, or the negation or the exclusion of the negation of others. The most basic is definition. We decide what a cow is, but then he inverts it in Uji, where he takes the category of the present moment and says that no beings or worlds are excluded, so that this inversion collapses the category. It becomes everything, or just the present moment without a name. You could do that with anything by adding or including everything in something in a name. For instance, the more sophisticated I think we touched on with the Genjo Koan, where you don't affirm, deny, or predicate anything about realization, Buddha practice. You simply refuse to reify it, make it into a thing. It's there, but not it's not asserted as being. Or content without a sign. No plus or minus, no affirmation or denial. It's not an easy state to arrive at. You might consider your relationship with someone. Suppose it had no signs, no pluses or minuses, or it wasn't affirmed or denied. It wasn't even reified as something separate. Oh, I forgot that Kanza in bringing up or in translating thought cover the literal Sanskrit under with Kanza's translation is the hindrance from what is cognizable or what is thinkable, dualism, or the belief in separate entities. I think that's Kanza's translation. Citta avarana.
Red Pine translates that citta avarana as walls of the mind.
Walls of the mind.
Different flavor.
So citta is translated as mind. Mind cover is probably better, huh? Just have to remove the cover. Well, it occurred to me recently that the Heart Sutra, which is chanted frequently, has a similar structure where you get negation of Abhidhamma, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. In Western theology, that's via negativa. You just keep denying. But then instead of leaving you at zero, a very interesting thing occurs at the end where a mantra is asserted as dependable, what the bodhisattva depends on. A mantra is the same root as mania. It's a magical solution. Has anyone chanted that mantra? Gate, gate, endlessly? I mean, just done a mantra practice with gate, gate. And how was that?
I wouldn't distinguish it from any other mantra where you like just exhaust your mind, basically, like just nourishing with the syllables and just out of that just experience a certain opening. But then I think Omala Padmanabhan would do probably. Maybe it has a little different quality, but it's doing the same thing. You know, you relax. You relax the mind.
I don't know if anyone has seen the film Doskedin, the Kurosawa with the autistic boy. Thinks he's a locomotive and his mother keeps chanting a mantra. If you do it often enough, the syllables fuse together and you just get an amalgam of sound. So I guess my question is, why the primacy of sound? Why does the Heart Sutra take us to almost a single point of sound? Not visual, but sound. If you've done mantra practice, you have that experience of the words fusing together and just sound, boom, not distinct, and the meaning goes pretty quickly.
Yeah,
I'm almost thinking that, in listening, and a level of listening goes beyond your own identifying as a listener. That the sound itself goes beyond sound in that way. So you're not thinking about hearing. No ear, no eyes, no it's beyond really the organ hearing. It's beyond listening, as we think of listening with our mind or our thoughts, is a presence of something not identifiable in our normal state of thinking, perhaps.
Well, do you want to draw the conclusion that that would be deeper than a visual practice, say, visualization of a deity or some Manjushri?
I hadn't considered that. It's just like seeing could perhaps do the same, have the same result of beyond the eye. It's like it's something that's just existing. Sight is beyond beyond the eye, so to speak. I haven't thought about one being, I haven't drawn a conclusion as it being more.
I think in the idea of yatras, that is the same essence of vibrational essence is supposed to be reached by contemplating a yantra, a visual diagram that sets a certain pattern in motion in your brain. It's supposed to penetrate to the same depth as a mantra. So I don't know.
Just that the structure of the Heart Sutra, which is chanted frequently, is a negation of the most sophisticated of Buddhist teachings, and then you end up with a mantra.
And a mantra, yeah. That's true, and yeah.
You're giving up.
It has to do with the vibrational nature of existence. You know? Even in science, if you get down to the level of strings, each string is a non-massive, zero mass vibration, and every single string has a different configuration when it vibrates. So it's really a different, in essence, a different sound. Everything is a big symphony, right from the very tiniest building block.
Oh. In that sense, visual would be secondary?
I don't think so, because I think when you get to that level, when you're talking about that vibrational essence, the vibration's vibration, and then in a sense, that's just my own perspective.
Well, the Old Testament says, in the beginning was the Word.
Yeah, I know.
We out of time? Yeah. Well, thank you.